This is WCRS, and today my very special guest is Congressman Jeff Duncan. He's home on recess. Are you having a vacation, or what's going on, Jeff? I checked your Facebook page. You've been busy.
Yeah, I didn't hear the bell ring when they called us to recess. I guess it's a work period for us, and spent a lot of time around the district, a lot of things that we needed to get to.
What are you hearing from people? What are you hearing? I know you've been at several businesses in Anderson. That was yesterday, day before you were
from the business community. They know NAFTA is going to get renegotiated, so they want to inform me about the impact that may have on their business, pro or con, with the renegotiation of that. Hear a lot about North Korea, a lot of concern out there from folks about the possibility of the United States having some sort of military action in North Korea. A lot of frustration with Washington and us not getting the things done that we promised the voters, and I share that frustration. You know, we've talked about it before. We voted to repeal Obamacare I don't know how many zillion times, and we had 7 years knowing that we might win the presidency and have an opportunity to have a replacement bill, and just couldn't get it done. So I'm as frustrated as everybody on that, but there are some things coming up that I think we have some opportunity. We're going to have tax reform.
We are going to have tax reform.
Yeah, we'll have a tax reform bill out of the House. Now, I can't speak for the Senate, and if you get Tim or Lindsey in here, I'd be glad to have you ask them that question. But we will have a tax reform bill out of the House, and hopefully it will allow repatriation or bringing overseas earnings back into this country, tax them at a different rate than the 36% or whatever, a lower rate, 10, 12, 15% would be more palatable to the folks to bring that money back. Plus, it'd be a shot in the arm, a huge cash infusion in the federal government on that taxes that we could use to pay for infrastructure, roads, bridges, port deepening, that sort of thing. And we need to spend that money wisely on that tax amount. Lowering the rates to make it more palatable for average Americans that are working every day so they can keep more of their hard-earned money to spend at places like businesses here in Greenwood. And businesses, too, make a fair tax structure where businesses can keep more of their money.
Well, how about making it so it's a little form, a short form that we can fill out.
They're talking about language now. I held up a postcard earlier. We should be able to use a postcard. Here's what I earned. Here's my deduction. Well, standard deduction, mortgage interest, whatever. Here's my deduction.
Right.
Exactly. Here's my net taxable income.
Right.
Here's the 15% tax. Right. You withheld that amount out of my paycheck, so I don't owe you anything.
You've already been paid.
Here's my stamp. This is my return. So right. You can verify what I've had, and I've signed it. It should be that simple. And that's what we hope to do in Congress, is make a simpler, flatter, fairer tax structure for all Americans to keep more of their money. Whether you're a business, C-Corp, S-Corp, LLC, or an individual, have a fair, flatter tax rate. Make it easier for you to pay the taxes you owe your government, and then allow you to keep more of that money so you can reinvest in your business or reinvest in yourself or spend in the economy.
Then we wouldn't need as big an IRS department, would we?
We could shrink the IRS. If all they had to look at was one postcard that I just held up, you can't see this. I'm holding this postcard up in here, but we're on the radio. You wouldn't need all those people to pour through those pages and looking at the deductions to make sure that they were applicable under the law. We could shrink that thousands of pages of IRS code down to something a lot more simpler, and I think that's what Republican Congress wants to do.
That's what the Congress wants to do, but so far we haven't been able to see the movement that I think everybody was excited about when we had Republican, Republican, and Republican, the White House, the Senate, and the Congress.
Yeah, the little caveat that folks don't understand, and which is probably the biggest hurdle and frustration that we have, is that most legislation takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass.
Mm-hmm.
That's under their rules. That's not in the Constitution. But the way they govern themselves under the rules, it takes 60 votes to pass general legislation. You remember the nuclear option on Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. To only allow 51 vote, a simple majority. You know, a lot of us are urging our Senate colleagues to get to a simple majority, a majority of the
sure.
Senate, to pass general legislation. Then we wouldn't have these hiccups that we've had. I say that, but then we have Obamacare that only needed 51 votes, and they still couldn't get that done. So I just think it'd be easier if we had the rule change over there, but I'm in the House, they're in the Senate, and they're not listening to me.
You know, I think that that's one of the things that most people are very frustrated about is the Affordable Care Act. And do you believe that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay?
You know, Senator Graham spoke yesterday. He's got a plan. He wants to try to get jump started again in September. I'm part of a group that are signing a discharge petition in the House to really try to force some action to bring up the 2015 reconciliation bill, a bill that repealed Obamacare that we actually sent to President Obama's desk and he vetoed. If we're willing to send that bill to President Obama's desk, we should be willing to send that same bill to President Trump's desk.
Then why hasn't it gone there? Why hasn't it since the beginning, since January? Why hasn't that gone?
Because of the makeup of the conference, there are a lot of people that are from areas of the nation that they may have won as a Republican, but they're in districts that are D+2, D+3, or maybe R+1. I mean, they're not very strong Republican or Democrat, but they may be more Democrat-leaning, that they don't want to repeal Obamacare. They're listening to their constituents who don't want them to repeal Obamacare, and we call them the majority makers. They're the ones that win those swing districts and give us enough votes to be in the majority, and it seems like our leadership caters more to them than to even their constituents who they told on the campaign trail. And I read their campaign literature.
Right.
I read a lot of literature from a lot of my colleagues all across the nation. They say the same thing I do, but when they get to Washington, they don't act that way. And that's a shame.
So I ask you again, do you think the Affordable Care Act is here to stay?
No, I don't. I mean, it's going to implode on its own, and it is. So you're seeing providers pulling out of states every day. We have one provider in South Carolina now. That's monopolistic. You don't have competition. They can determine what plans are going to sell and what price they're going to put on that.
Well, so that brings me to another question, Jeff. If you can't repeal Obamacare at this juncture, why can you not take pieces of it and, like, selling insurance across state lines? Wouldn't that change the whole focus right there?
It would. I'd love to see that and associational health care plans being the first two things we do. But there again, the caveat is those type pieces of legislation would take 60 votes in the Senate. So you've got to convince at least 8 Democrats to vote to go along with that. I think you can probably get 2 or 3, Joe Manchin being one of them. His governor just switched parties. And, you know, I think he's somebody that probably would go along. But you're still a few votes shy. So in order to get that, you're going to either need to attach it as two must-pass pieces of legislation, like a government funding bill, a debt ceiling increase. It's something I've advocated for. I've told Speaker Ryan that we shouldn't pass a clean debt ceiling increase. Let's pass a debt ceiling increase that allows across state line sales or allows associational health care plans as part of our replacement for Obamacare. And that's something I've advocated for. Now,
but if that was a separate piece of legislation, it would not. You don't believe it would pass in the Senate?
I think it takes 60, and I don't think that the Democrat senators over there that are so enthralled with Obamacare would vote to make any changes to Obamacare.
What about, so, all right.
Because so you get into that stumbling block we just talked about, that there's a 60-vote threshold in the Senate for general legislation. And so,
well, why doesn't McConnell change it?
That's a great question for you to ask our senators. You know, I've advocated for a long time, even before
this
year.
Well, I remember when they went to this, when the Democrats were in control, and everybody said, you will rue the day when you get in charge.
Right.
That this
is the way.
And
so they did on judges, they did on judicial nominees, and if you're willing to do it there, let's do it. You know, I've said all along, the Democrats were willing to change the rules in order to hurt America, and I say hurt America in the judicial side of it and in their appointments, but we're not willing to change the rules to try to save America and save America from the rubble it's become. I say that in that we've got big government, and government's involved in a lot of different aspects of our lives that our founders never envisioned. So we're trying to rebuild this nation from the rubble it's become in so many ways, and we're not willing to change the rules, which aren't in the Constitution, other than it says each chamber will determine the rules it governs itself under. They need to change the rules. But I've been very clear on that, so I'm not saying anything that my senators and even friends of mine, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and others, haven't heard me say.
Sure.
So they're standing behind this institution known as the United States Senate and its rules, and it's to the detriment of moving a conservative agenda forward.
Absolutely. Well, what about, so you're telling me that, what about tort reform, though? Surely that would have an effect on the cost of health care. Can we not do something
on
that?
Yeah, so the House passed a little bit of tort reform this year, but some would make the argument, and Trey Gowdy's one that would, because he's an attorney, that there are not a lot of federal torts to begin with, and the federal government doesn't have a big role when it comes to tort reform. And torts are just the legal side of people being able to sue in civil court, hospitals or doctors and that sort of thing, frivolous lawsuits or actual lawsuits, and what the claims are. Now, we worked on that when I was in the General Assembly to lower some of the potential settlements and to keep people from changing venues. So if you got hurt in Greenwood, you could not have the trial in Greenwood. You would move it to Hampton, South Carolina, to Hampton County, where the rewards were historically a lot higher, and generally the juries ruled in favor of the plaintiff, right?
Right.
So we did away with that. You couldn't change venues anymore. You couldn't court shop. But the federal government doesn't have a lot of role in that. The state government still has most of the role in tort reform. But where we can be involved,
yes,
from the federal level, we should be. Because any changes to torts and that arena that we can do will have a positive impact, I think.
Now, you know, one of the things that I keep looking at is the involvement of lobbyists in the running of whether it's our state government or our federal government. What I personally think, if we could remove a lot of this lobbyist, we might be able to drain the swamp a little quicker.
Yeah, I mean, so I can only talk for me. I'm not in leadership. We have lobbyists come visit with us, and me personally or my staff, and I've always looked at lobbying and lobbyists as a source of information.
Have the time. They do have the time to research and do this type
of
thing.
Right, and they're advocating a certain position, but a good congressman or a good legislator listens to the lobbyists on the other side as well, right? There's
right.
always
Should.
Pros and cons.
Yep.
And I did that. And when I was in the state legislature, we truly had lobbyists that were in the lobby, right?
They stayed in the lobby?
That's how they got their name.
Okay.
So I could walk outside the chamber doors and go visit with lobbyists from both sides of the issue.
Right.
And really try to understand, if we were voting on, let's say, waste. And let's say it was nuclear waste at a low-level nuclear repository in Barnwell, South Carolina. I could talk to the companies that were storing that waste and taking the waste from out-of-compact states. And I could also talk to the environmentalist side of it,
mm-hmm,
and the county government side that reaped some benefits. So I could really get all sides of the issue and really try to come up to an informed decision before I cast a vote. In Washington, I can't easily walk out into the lobby because it just doesn't work that way. Even though they're called lobbyists, they're not hanging out in the lobby anymore. They're coming around and visiting our offices, or we know who they are.
Sending you to dinner, sending dinner, sending food. I mean, you know, are they?
None of that.
None
of that happens anymore. That's against ethics laws. So,
okay.
Now, we've changed a lot of laws in this country with regard to what lobbyists could or could not do for and with legislators. You know, not even a cup of coffee was the term in Columbia when I was down there. They couldn't even buy you a cup of coffee. And all that's
so
a good thing.
So all the lobbyists are taking each other out to eat? Is that right?
Lobbyists can take each other out to eat all day long, but they can't take members of legislature out. So in Washington, we know, let's say, the lobbyists for an energy issue. We know who they are. And if I have a question, we can call them in, or my staff can call them in, and we can meet with them and get all the information on that issue. And if we do our job right, we should call the lobbyist on the other side of the issue and ask them to send some information. Or they'll come see us, and we take that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So because I can't know, I'm a pretty smart guy.
Yes, you are, Jeff.
But I can't know.
Okay, Jeff's smart.
I can't know everything about everything.
Sure.
And I'm not a mile wide, an inch deep. I'm a little deeper than that. But I'm still not well-versed on every topic.
Sure.
Juvenile diabetes or offshore drilling, low-level nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain or Obamacare. I can't know everything I need
sure.
to know.
Sure, I understand that.
So we have to rely on that outside source. And that's the positive side of lobbying.
Okay, now give me the negative side.
The negative side is if you see someone influencing a legislator through perks. And really, I don't see that because we live within the ethics laws.
But there's an awful lot of money.
Apparently it happens.
Yes,
right?
A lot
I'm just
of money,
saying,
yes.
Yeah. Apparently it happens because there wouldn't be the dander wouldn't be up across the nation and the state over lobbying in general if some of that hadn't happened. So I'd see I see where it can go wrong, but I also understand the valuable, the value of having
experts,
advocates, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, I agree, but I do think that there is a lot of influence that goes on with.
And look, you've lobbied me before.
Yes.
The Radio Association, the broadcasters or whatever,
sure.
They've been in my office and talked
Absolutely.
To me about broadcasting.
Yeah.
And everybody's their own special interest group. You have your special interest. I have my special interest. The outdoor community has their special interest. The doctors have their special interest.
Sure.
You know, the abortionists have their special interest, and pro-life people have theirs. Everybody has their own special interest. So everybody at some time when they have a chance to talk with a congressman or a senator, they're going to lobby.
You know, I would have no problem if that's where it ended.
Right.
I would have no problem if I'm my own best advocate for whatever. I have no problem with that. What I have a problem is I know there's when you look at the amount of dollars that are spent through the lobbyist organizations, it'll just blow you away.
Yes.
I mean, $194,000 from the hospital lobby down there in South Carolina at the State House.
Really?
Yeah. Really? Yeah. What were they spending the money on? I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Anyways, let's move on.
But let me just on that same genre. So people would say that I support offshore drilling because I've gotten all this money from the energy companies. When in reality, I was supporting offshore drilling before I ever ran for Congress. I'm pretty well educated on the whole aspects of offshore drilling, and I advocate for it because I see it's a win-win for the state. I see it's a win-win for energy independence and all that.
And how about for outdoor people?
I'm sorry?
How about for the outdoor people, the people that want the
environmentalists? Look, I can have the conversation, and I'm supported by the conservation movement. Not all conservation is out there support me.
But
because there's a lot of different kinds. But so the energy companies see somebody who knows, and they know they will have somebody that's educated and advocating for a position they like. They support me, right?
Right.
But
they
just
contribute
like,
to your campaign. Is that what you're saying?
Contribute to
my campaign.
Within the limits.
Yes.
So there are limits, federal guidelines that require they can only contribute X number of dollars per cycle, right?
Right.
So, but on the flip side of that, there are people that Planned Parenthood, I'll give them an example. Planned Parenthood will support a Democrat candidate who believes in keeping the federal tax dollars flowing to Planned Parenthood because they provide abortion.
Right.
So they will contribute to the federal maximum amount to that person's campaign. How is that any different? And it's not.
No.
I'll get beat up because I'm a lifetime member of the NRA. I'm a firearms enthusiast. I believe in the Second Amendment. And I'm going to support those issues. I'm going to support those issues whether NRA helps me or not. NRA has stepped up and helped contribute to my campaign within the federal guidelines for federal contributions. But at the same token, there are people who don't like the Second Amendment, who want to take our guns away, and there are campaigns that will advocate for some of those things. And the groups that support no firearms, et cetera, will contribute to their campaigns.
Right.
It doesn't influence how I vote. I was already voting there, supporting those issues before I ever got the first dollar, before I ever ran. So,
well, somebody might make the issue, well, do you support them more now since you get support more?
My voting record's so consistent. Oh, my gosh.
You know. I'm just saying, you know, that's how somebody, you
can
you know,
fault,
the
you can fault me
factor.
For a lot of things, but I'm pretty consistent on my stances. I don't go back and forth.
I'm just saying.
I'm definitely not out here doing this.
You know, I think the spin that is put on everything out there is phenomenal. I really don't see how anybody survives with the spin that is constantly going on about a candidate saying this, a congressman saying this, Senate, whatever. I mean, just look at what happens to President Trump every day of the week.
Yeah.
The media and the whole spin factor. But one of the things that I also want to talk, one more question about healthcare is why can't we make the FDA move a little faster? Why can't we speed up, fast track some of their things, and particularly maybe separate what's happening in pharmaceuticals versus what's happening in biomechanical? I mean, it just seems like they are in slow-mo, and we've got people's lives on the line.
Yeah, I agree they ought to be faster, but I think they approach things with human lives in store. I mean, they don't want to put a drug out there that's going to cause, you know, catastrophic heart damage or liver damage. And when they do, they pull the pharmaceuticals. So, You know, do we want to rush putting pharmaceuticals on the market that may have adverse risk, or do we want to be cautious? And I kind of come down on both sides of that.
Well, so maybe even more testing for people who are, you know, in a desperate situation. You know, how do we get a drug to the public eventually?
You know, if Europe is approving drug, Canada's approving drug, and it is a life-saving drug that someone's willing to sign on the dotted line, they're not going to hold anybody liable if they take it, and it's already approved in some other areas, it's just us slow-walking it, maybe they ought to be part of an experimental group and allow mm-hmm. them to get that possibly life-saving treatment. While we're testing, let's test it on them.
Right.
If they're willing to do that.
Exactly.
And I'm not saying about a brand new pharmaceutical that's never been approved. If it's already approved in other nations, they've done some testing. Let's rely on some of that while we're doing our own testing before
exactly.
So I think there's a solution to this. And I think that's an administration question. That ought to be a director question for
sure.
HHS or the head of FDA.
Now, you know, one of the other things that I find very interesting is that the Democrats, they always seem to fall in line. And I can remember when I first started going to Washington and meeting with you, and you, Trey Gowdy, Mulvaney, all of you all used to talk about them trying to whip you into shape. Right? And I can remember when it was, I think it was on the Affordable Care Act, that y'all ended up in the chapel there, and you were all praying about what was the right thing to do, and a lot of pressure had been put on you. No, it wasn't the affordable, it must have been on the budget, debt ceiling, raising a debt ceiling.
Debt ceiling.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that y'all went there, and you just stood firm. But the Democrats seem to always come together. Why is that? Why is there such a difference? Why is that the Republicans can't seem to get together and be a strong bloc? I take, for example, John McCain just voting in the other direction on the Affordable Care Act.
You ask me to comment on what John McCain does or doesn't
no,
do.
No, no, not
stretch.
John McCain. No, no. No, but I'm using that as an example, right?
Yeah.
I mean, here we had something that was crucial. It was crucial, and yet three Republicans did not vote for it, and John McCain was the surprise on that. But why is it the Democrats always seem to be tight together, whether they've read the bill or not? You know, the leadership says you're voting this way, and they all stand in line. Republicans seem to scatter, and that is part of the problem, I think, why we can't get together on some of these bills.
I agree. I've tried to analyze it, and there are members of our conference that run as Republicans that are from districts that are D+1, D+2. They're called majority maker members. They're the ones that are in the swing state that give us the majority or them the majority. And so they don't vote as Republicans a lot. They will vote, I guess they vote their district, and they represent them. Maybe they should. But on issues that are Republican issues like marriage, mm-hmm. they will vote with the Democrats. On issues like, not raising the debt ceiling without getting some sort of spending cuts that are changing the trajectory, they won't do that because they don't like the controversy. They just want to raise the debt ceiling and not work on the solution. I call them, they're purple people, purple members. Mm-hmm. They're from purple districts. We just saw recently on a LGBT issue where Vicki Hartzler from Missouri had an amendment on the National Defense Authorization Act. And her amendment said this amendment would deny the Department of Defense the ability to spend any money on transgender or gender-altering surgery.
Correct.
Well, it was just saying don't take the tax dollars from people in South Carolina, Missouri, and spend them on things we don't agree with, and that is gender-altering surgery. Now, I'm fine if somebody wants to alter their gender on their time and their dime.
Sure.
They shouldn't take that. There's only so many military slots available every year. We only have so many people we're paying serving our military. And they're taking one of those slots, and they're not active. They're not able to be active, activated to serve in a frontline unit while they're going through their transgender surgery and their hormone therapy and their
all
mental
that.
Counseling
yep.
and all that.
Yep.
So they are taking a slot that an able-bodied American could take to pick up a weapon and fight for our country and defend our freedoms. And so they're taking up the time. And then while they're doing it, they're getting paid.
Right.
And they're also asking for your tax dollars to pay for their surgery to change. And I don't have a problem with them changing.
Right.
I can still love them just like I love anyone else. But they shouldn't take our tax dollars to do that. If they want to do it on their time and on their dime, that's their thing. If they want to come back and join the military in their new gender, if that role in their role in the military and their new gender fits that role and they can fulfill their duties, let them serve. I don't have a problem with them serving. But we just shouldn't ask for them to do that on our time and our dime. It should be on theirs.
Absolutely.
But I go back. So we had an amendment, and 24 Republicans voted against it. So 24 Republicans sided with the Democrats to take your tax dollars and let the DOD spend them to alter gender of individual servant. So those 24 get the majority of the National Republican Congressional Committee money to help them run their millions upon millions of dollars to help them run and win their election so that they will be in our conference and help us make the majority.
Right.
But yet they don't vote with us. And it's frustrating.
It's very frustrating. The whole thing is very frustrating. Hey, I tell you what, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. Don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
All right, and we're here with Congressman Jeff Duncan, and we are talking about all different issues here today. Jeff, you know, you went up there to D.C. to meet with Vice President Pence on Venezuela. They are in a crisis. They're trying to change the government there. But I ask you, what is the importance in Venezuela to us here in the United States?
Well, from a human standpoint, Venezuelan people are struggling and suffering. They have no participation in their government, really, no freedom of press, freedom of speech, access that we enjoy. President Maduro basically becoming a dictator. He tried to dismiss the whole General Assembly, they call a National Assembly, their Congress. The Supreme Court overruled him on that finally because of external pressure, rather. So then he decided to call for a constituent assembly, which is a constitutional Congress type thing, to change their government and give him more power and lessen the power of the General Assembly and the courts. And that's what dictators do. So that's what's happening. Solidify his power, become more of a dictator versus just some sort of socialist democratic state to become a true communist dictatorship, and like we see in Cuba. There's 100,000 Cuban strongmen in Venezuela. They're acting as his security force. It's not a good situation when Venezuelans are eating dogs and flamingos to try to stay alive, digging through garbage cans outside of restaurants just to find subsistence, crossing the Colombian border to buy toilet paper and basic human rights subsistence stuff, coming back into Venezuela or going over there and becoming refugees. It's a terrible situation, and the vice president's going to be traveling to the region, not to Venezuela, but to Colombia and Argentina and Chile and somewhere else, Panama maybe. And I chair the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee. I'm pretty well versed on issues affecting Latin America, and he wanted my advice.
So is the United States willing to act in some way, or what are we looking to do?
So we already are, and we're acting in a multinational fashion in that we've put sanctions. President Trump issued sanctions on 13 Venezuelan people within the government primarily, and I think some more sanctions will come about, limit their ability to trade with other nations, and it's not just us acting unilaterally. At the same time, Panama issued the same sanctions on the same people. Argentina's been involved. Colombia's been involved. There's been a multinational effort, which is so important because if it was just the United States acting along unilaterally, it would give propaganda material to President Maduro to use, to support his regime and blame us. Mm-hmm. Well, he can't blame us. He can't blame us when Panama and Colombia and Venezuela and Argentina and other countries are doing the same thing. And so we're trying to stand firm at the Organization of the American States, which is a organization created to support democratic principles within the hemisphere, to stand with them and encourage all their countries to condemn Venezuela on the National or Constituent Assembly. Now, there's some countries that you would think would stand with the United States and the OAS, but they're not. Haiti and Dominican Republic, El Salvador come to mind. I've had conversations with the president of Haiti and Dominican Republic recently, phone call with El Salvador. I've had their ambassadors in my office, and I've chastised them and really been stern over what the United States Congress feels about them not acting with the OAS and standing for democratic principles with regard to Venezuela.
Yeah. You know, also, isn't it kind of a it's kind of a king point area between everything? If Venezuela goes, does that mean that the other countries on either side could go?
Well, not on either side, but it does mean that you will see more socialist activity. I mean, Mexico is concerned. They have a big socialist movement within the country of Mexico. The president there is concerned about what could happen. If you see success in Venezuela, then the socialists are going to point to that. Even though what we see in Venezuela right now are people are suffering. You know, people are starving, and they don't have the basic necessities.
Are in North Korea, too, and yet people are jumping up and saying that they'll become the head of a nuclear bomb coming here to the United States.
Yeah, that's, you know, comparing Venezuela and North Korea at this point in time, it's kind of a stretch, but definitely both socialistic dictatorships, and or at least headed that way. We're concerned about Venezuelan people when it comes right down to human rights, basic human rights and oppression of people, and people are being locked up as political prisoners for no reason. You know, they don't have access to the judiciary and attorneys and be able to get out. They don't have a constitution like ours, and that's unfortunate. It's alarming.
From that standpoint, it absolutely is. But then there are other countries that have similar type situations.
Cuba's one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Cuba.
Show me Cuban people that are happy, that have access to the internet, that can communicate regularly, that understand what's going on in the world, that aren't driving 1950 Chevrolets, that have...
Oh, come on, that's cool.
That is cool. I'd love to have one, and they know how to repair them and all that good stuff. But they don't have air conditioning. They don't have basic access to information that we have. They can't speak out if they're frustrated with their government. They don't have the right to peacefully assemble. They don't have participation in their governance. They give 90% of their income to the Cuban government. They're working for 10 cents on the dollar of what they earn. I mean, I could go on and on and
sure,
on and on.
Exactly. But
that's what happens in big government dictatorships like that. I don't point to Cuba as a shining example for Venezuela to become. Now, Venezuela and Maduro would point to Cuba as somewhere that they would want to come.
Yeah, okay.
Hello.
Yep, sorry. All right. All right. So as we kind of get to winding things up here, the big issue right now, North Korea getting ready to fire 3 or 4 nuclear warheads too close to Guam. Is that going to happen?
It would be a mistake for him to do that. You know, North Korea has nuclear weapon. They've proven that. They don't have the ability to put a nuclear weapon on ICBM at this point and send it to the United States. They don't need.
Well, they say that. Well, then, so it wasn't true that they could make it here to the United States.
Hold that thought a minute.
Okay.
They don't need an ICBM to hit Guam, which they could do with a long-range ballistic missile, not an intercontinental. So that is within their sphere, Guam, Tokyo.
Yes.
And
Gracie wants to come in. Yeah,
I was going to ask about the dog. So the thing with an ICBM, they do have the ability now, apparently, to send a missile up into the stratosphere, into space. But it's a little different trying to get a reentry vehicle to bring that nuclear warhead back through the atmosphere and reentry without it burning up, and at the same time targeting. So it's one thing to launch a missile up into space and be done with it. It's another thing to hit it, launch it up into space, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and still hit your target. I don't think they're there yet. They could be. I'm not a intelligence guy, but I'm very intelligent, but I'm not an intelligence actor. So I don't know where they are, but I know Donald Trump knows, and I know General Mattis knows. One thing I will say is President Trump has a commitment to make sure we got the most professional, well-prepared military in the world, and he's not someone I would bluff around with. And I think through his statements recently and then backed up by Secretary Mattis's statements, which I thought articulated a little more less flamboyant but very clear, I think what they do is they get China engaged at this point. China doesn't want to see a war on the peninsula. They need both countries as trading partners. They definitely need us. And so this was a warning to North Korea to back down, stop this, and a statement to China, in my opinion, to get engaged in this, to avert this.
What do you think about Ambassador Nikki Haley and what they pulled together up there at the United Nations?
I think she's done a great job. She did a great job with the Security Council on North Korea and the sanctions. She's been a multinational sanction effort against North Korea. So we're not standing alone on this. And actually, China and Russia are part of the Security Council. So you can look at their statements and their involvement in the Security Council. So I think Nikki, Ambassador Haley's done a great job. I think she's had to really throttle back some things. I mean, she had a learning curve, right? Mm-hmm. Foreign policy wasn't her suit. She was
right.
Governor. She had a learning curve. She had to throttle back some of her comments and really represent what President Trump wants to say at the UN and the State Department's policies. But I think she has done a great job. I applaud her. She came to our committee and testified. She knocked it out of the park, even with some hard questioning by some Democrats on the other side. I thought she did a great job. Mm-hmm. I sent her a text afterwards, and I got to introduce her, by the way. That was kind of
right.
Cool to introduce the former governor and Ambassador Haley and a friend of mine. I sent her a text afterwards and applauded her and told her what a good job she did. So we communicate by text, and you know, she's doing a great job representing not only the great state of South Carolina. If you notice, she wears a South Carolina pendant
every time,
all the time. So
yep.
She's proud of being a South Carolinian, and that just warms my heart. But she's also representing the United States government very well at the UN globalist institution that it is.
Now, speaking of President Trump and everything, they've had a rough time over the last few months getting staff, getting everything in place. Do you think that they are finally on a path? What is the feeling in Washington about President Trump and his management style, I guess we could call it?
he had a learning curve as well. He's a business leader. But I'll tell you what. Naming General Kelly as his chief of staff and what I've seen General Kelly do in the last 14 days has been a good thing. And I think the first thing General Kelly did was come in and say, we need to clear out the West Wing mm-hmm. and get everybody out of here. We're going to look for electronic surveillance, bugs. We're going to, while we're doing it, we're going to take care of some physical needs within the West Wing, which they're doing. I was up there Tuesday. Their cranes are redoing the air conditioning. They're really going back to the foundation, really doing a lot of work. The Vice President is out of his office as well. So for 17 days, Donald Trump's not on vacation. He moved the West Wing, all the employees and everywhere, at no cost to the taxpayer, to a facility so they can continue operating the executive branch while they do the needed renovations on the West Wing. And I think that was probably a big part attributed to Secretary Kelly or General Kelly. I'm going to go back to calling him General Kelly.
Right.
Because he was at Southcom. He and I worked together, Western Hemisphere, Southcom, all worked closely together. I got to know him there. When he was named Secretary of DHS, I was happy about that because I know the kind of guy he is. I'm even happier now mm-hmm. that he's over in the White House as chief of staff because I know he's a no-nonsense straight shooter and he's going to get to the bottom of all the leaks, whether they're electronic leaks or physical leaks. He's going to systematically work through the process as a general does
right.
and find the source and get rid of it.
Well, you know, and what about all the appointments that are really lagging behind for President Trump?
United States Senate, do you hear? We need some confirmation. We need to end the obstructionism of Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, and we need to move some of these nominees. I wasn't there when Obama became president and had these nominees. I don't know the makeup of Congress. I'd have to research that and how quickly they moved. I don't know that we're ahead of the curve, behind the curve, or what. I just don't know. I know it seems like it's molasses pace over there and
right.
getting these, especially on the bench and judiciary, lower courts, not the Supreme Court. So I hope they'll. That's probably why we should have worked through August, is to, at least on the Senate side, to work through that, if nothing else.
Yeah, you know, what happened to that? I thought they were going to, they were talking about working. Then Obamacare failed and they just went home?
I guess when John McCain did a thumbs down and that failed, then they decided
all bets were off?
Yeah, I guess so.
Let's just go home and lick our wounds.
Yeah, you know, there's a punt in football. You drop back, you regroup. So I think that's where we are. And I think it's good for the senators and the House members to go back and do these kind of interviews, be asked questions, talk to folks in the district, hear what they have to say. And maybe they're getting an awakening that they need to work a little harder when we get back. And I was willing to work through August, so I'm ready to work on all the things that are teed up for us. Debt ceiling increase, funding bill by the end of September, flood insurance reauthorization, a budget, appropriations bills, Obamacare repeal, tax reform, infrastructure bill, all that's coming up, and a lot of that has to be done before September 30th.
So really you have less than a month to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, once you go back.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's,
I think,
a lot to 17, put in there.
17 legislative days. So.
And now for my final, really my final question here, Jeff. How, whatever happened with the Scalise.
Steve Scalise.
And how are you doing? What have they actually found out? Anything more, or is it over and done with?
Yeah, so my friend Steve Scalise is in rehab hospital. He's been discharged from the medical hospital, and he's in a rehab hospital. He's having to rehab to walk again. His pelvis and hip were shattered. That had to heal, and then he's got to start getting some mobility back in that hip joint, and then he's got to start putting weight on it and learn how to mobilize again. All the while, you know, his lower extremities, his gut, for lack of any other words, got to heal too. And so it's delicate, but he's doing much better. He's at a rehab hospital, and I know he's eager to get back. We're eager to see him. We're eager to have him back on the floor. It'll be a sigh of relief for a lot of us to see him walk back out on the floor after what he went through and what we all went through.
How are you doing? And did they ever find out any more information as to why he had your name in his pocket?
Yeah, so he had six of us on a list, and we talked to the FBI about that, and the commonality of the six were Freedom Caucus, but not necessarily that. There are some members on that list that you wouldn't even know were Freedom Caucus, so we don't know that that's it. Conservative members, yes, all in the same office building. And we believe the office building was the commonality that he had on the list, because he had surveyed the Rayburn House office building for about 4 hours. We do know that.
Wow. Before that day, yeah, or in previous days?
Prior to that.
Okay.
This was back in April. He had brought his weapons. He'd purchased a handgun after Donald Trump was elected. He already had the rifle. He had modified the rifle with a collapsible stock so he could conceal it much better. He had modified the rifle to take a detachable magazine, which had been designed to do. He had modified that himself. He brought those weapons from Illinois to Washington. Didn't have a home to go to, didn't have a job, living in his van. He came to commit some sort of act against people he disagreed with. And he surveyed a certain building. Our names were on the list, but it looked like he had written them down, folded it, put it in his wallet, and never revisited it. So we don't know that that was that active. But he did have that, and that is alarming to us that are on the list, and we've asked the questions. He committed to shoot at my colleagues on the baseball field, and God looked after me and got me off the field before it happened. You know, luckily everyone's surviving and rehabbing and getting out of it. It's a miracle, really, that that nobody got hurt any worse than they did, that nobody died. And if you look at where the gentleman was standing behind the third base dugout, or beside the third base dugout, and when he pulled the trigger, and how close it was, and radio can't see this, but I'm going to show Ann, that first shot hit the fence.
Wow.
You see the chain link right there.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
You see how close third base is.
Wow.
He had a rifle. If he'd have taken his time and aimed and not rushed it, Trent Kelly, my friend from Mississippi, would be dead right now, because he was standing at third base. I would have been standing at shortstop had I still been on the field. So we know a lot about the shooter. We know he acted alone. He didn't seem to have any connection to any outside groups or whatnot. And he's dead. So we're moving on. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been great to have you in studio with us here today.
It's great to be here. I love Ann and WCRS and 98.5 and 1450 AM, and it's great to be here. I'm glad you're in your new digs. I was telling her earlier, folks, that she's got Tiffany lamps in here, and how many studios you go into that have antiques and Tiffany lamps and that sort of thing. But it looks like sharp facets on steroids in here. So.
Well, thank you very much. Congressman Jeff Duncan, good to have you in studio. I know you got a full day headed on, and we'll be playing this interview this afternoon at 4 o'clock. So if you've got some time, tune in.
If I'm in the car, I'll do my best.
All right. Thanks so much, Congressman Jeff Duncan. Bye-bye, everybody.